She looked at V. I might seem a bit weird at work tomorrow.
More than normal?
Martha smiled. I'm going to the hospital first thing for an appointment. She stalled for a second. At the Royal Edinburgh. V looked nonplussed. That's the psychiatric hospital in Morningside.
There's a psychiatric hospital in Morningside?
Martha nodded. I'm due for an ECT dose.
ECT? Like, please don't say cuckoo's nest.
Okay. Martha's mouth was running away with her. Whiskey fueled.
It's nothing like that. It just resets things. Me and Cal both have depression. I've tried every medication going. Nothing stuck. I always felt I was still suffocating. I get regular doses of ECT and it works.
V took a sip of her whiskey.
Why the fuck are you coming into work after that?
It's no big deal. I feel fine after. I want to get on with things. V shook her head.
Don't be a hard ass. Take the day off. I can cover. Been doing it enough.
I want to work.
Are there any side effects?
A bit groggy from the anaesthetic. Maybe some short-term memory loss. V held her hand up.
Whoa, lady, there's really no need.
Cal piped up. I told you. Martha looked at Billy, thought about brains and minds. Maybe, she said. She plonked herself down next to Billy and clinked his glass. Cal got up and began dancing with V to Soundgarden, a slow, smoochy dance, both of them making a joke of it. Martha turned to Billy. How's the hole in your head? He narrowed his eyes. You heard about that?
Read about it.
Billy rubbed at the back of his neck. Martha held his gaze.
Must have been a crazy time.
Billy shrugged.
Don't remember too much of it, actually. Took a shitload of morphine.
You were on the crags when it went on fire?
Yeah.
And there were guys shooting at each other?
Something like that.
Wow. He took a drink.
You know, Rose saved my life.
Really?
I owe her everything.
They didn't speak. The guy from Soundgarden was yelling about Jesus Christ.
How did Rose know about Gordon dying?
Martha said. Billy shook his head.
She's a reporter. It's her job to know stuff.
But this is our story.
There's no story. A guy from the office killed himself. That's it.
Martha thought for a moment.
There's a sound on the tape.
What?
After he shot himself, there's a sound on the tape.
What kind of sound?
A clunk or something.
What do you think it is?
I don't know. That's my point.
You think it wasn't suicide?
It's possible.
Martha refilled her whiskey glass.
Do you think you should? Billy said. The hospital and all that.
Martha took a drink and waved that away.
I wish you could know what it feels like. It wipes away all the shite that's accumulated. You start again with a clean slate. It's about getting a second chance.
Billy smiled. I know what that feels like.
Martha leaned in and kissed his cheek.
I suppose you do.
Gig number 2. The 7th of the 3rd, 92.
She wobbled as she left the Surrey Heat. Ian took her elbow and steadied her. That last joint had really messed with her head. They smoked it between the four of them on the walk from Queen Street Station, then nipped into the pub for a quick pint before heading across the road. She pulled the ticket from her pocket as they tottered across the road, the Barrowlands neon frontage making her eyes throb. She looked at the ticket. Regular Music Limited presents Soundgarden plus special guests Screaming Trees at Glasgow Barrowland. Saturday the 7th of March, doors 7 p.m, ticket £7 plus booking fee. Next to her, Ian was walking with an odd limp. His idea of hiding a few joints in a cassette case in his shoe seemed pretty ridiculous now.
The speed wrap she had tucked inside her pants was much less likely to get detected.
You're walking like an idiot.
Elaine turned.
Gordon was pointing at Ian, his arm around Sam.
They were inseparable. Elaine felt a twinge of something, not quite jealousy. She was happy Gordon had found someone after their brief knockabout together, but he and Sam were so boring these days. This was the first time they'd been out in ages. Sam was one of those girlfriends who locks down her man, takes him away from his mates, especially girl mates.
She looked at Ian. She wasn't like that with him. Couldn't understand women who were.
Ian gave Gordon the finger as he hurpled across the road, avoiding a taxi.
He won't be slagging me off when he wants a talk.
A guy was slumped unconscious against the wall of the Barras, another guy pissing up against Baird's bar next door.
Ian!
Coming towards them was a woman with big hair and big tits, exposed in a low-cut top. She was hanging off a skinny guy in a Pearl Jam long sleeve, peroxide hair to his shoulders. The woman was mid-twenties and had a look in her eyes as if she didn't take any shit off anybody.
Rose, Ian said.
Elaine watched as they greeted each other. They didn't touch. There was something unsettling about that, as if they were consciously avoiding it. But she was being paranoid. It was the skunk in that joint. She wasn't that kind of girl. She trusted him.
Rose, this is Elaine. Elaine, Rose is my boss at the Evening Standard.
Colleague, not boss, Rose said.
Elaine noticed that Ian hadn't mentioned that she was his girlfriend.
Stupid skunk.
I've heard all about you, she said to Rose.
Jesus, don't say that, Rose laughed. I dread to think what Ian's been saying about me.
Her voice made it clear she didn't dread it at all. She was confident and sexy and had no doubt that anyone talking about her would only say good things. Rose smiled.
He hasn't told me much about you.
Not much to tell, Elaine said.
I'm sure that's not true.
Rose turned to the guy she was hanging off.
This is Alex. He's reviewing tonight for the Standard.
Ian nodded.
I'm doing it for the evening paper.
This was a hierarchy thing. The Evening Standard was at the bottom, then the Standard, then the Sunday paper at the top. Ian had explained it to Elaine, who found the pettiness pathetic.
When's your deadline? Alex asked Ian.
Midnight.
You're lucky, man. I have to phone it in by 10. Probably miss the encores.
To make tomorrow's paper, the review had to be written on the spot and phoned into the office, 500 scribbled words mumbled drunkenly from a phone box. Gordon and Sam caught up with them and were introduced. Rose pointed at the entrance.
Shall we?
She walked in without waiting for an answer, her arse wiggling too much.
You never told me she was so pretty, Elaine said to Ian.
He put on an air of innocence.
Is she? I hadn't noticed.
Wrong answer.
But she was being ridiculous. She needed to get some more mellow grass next time.
Inside, the place was jumping, but the screaming trees were struggling. Mark Lanigan looked fucked, holding onto the mic stand for dear life. The two fat guitarists made up for it, rolling around on the stage and going nuts, but Lanigan stood there, eyes screwed shut, looking like he'd just drunk a pint of his own piss. Even nearly lost you sounded tame to Elaine. She excused herself to brave the bogs. Rose trooped along and stood with her in the queue.
How long have you and Ian been together? She said.
3 or 4 months.
Sounds pretty casual if you don't even know how long.
Elaine frowned.
4 months? What about you and Alex?
Rose laughed and flicked her hair.
That's just tonight to get on the guest list.
A cubicle became free and Elaine went in, pulled the speed wrap from her pants, unfolded it and dabbed some in her tongue. Felt her eyes ping open like a cartoon character's. Pissed and wiped, then left. Rose wasn't around, so she headed back upstairs and went straight to the bar. 3 pints of lager and a JD and Coke for Samantha. She wasn't buying for Rose or her fuck buddy. Harder to carry the pints in these thin plastic glasses, the JD jammed between her fingertips.
The house lights were up between bands. She looked through the crowd and spotted Ian, but he wasn't with Gordon and Sam. He was standing arguing with someone. She didn't approach them, but stood and watched, anonymous in the murmur of the crowd. The other guy was the same height as Ian, but broader across the shoulders. Better looking. Shoulder-length curly hair, high cheekbones, and even from here she could see he had sharp blue eyes. A Dinosaur Junior t-shirt clung to him, revealing muscle definition. Ian shook his head, then waved a dismissive hand. The other guy was pleading, hands out in supplication, but Ian was having none of it. He shoved the guy on the shoulder, and the guy just took it like he deserved it. He tilted his head to the side, trying to reason with Ian, who looked round as if he didn't want to be seen with this guy. Ian shook his head, then pushed past the guy and headed towards the bar, obviously looking for Elaine. She took a sip from one of the pints and stood watching the other guy. He looked crestfallen. Elaine's mind buzzed. This wasn't just an argument over a spilt pint. It looked like it mattered, like it meant something. The guy turned and headed toward the stairs. She saw Ian at the bar, craning his neck, looking for her. She headed towards him. "Where have you been?" he said. "Bogsden Bar," she said, handing him a pint. "I couldn't find you." They both took a drink. "What did I miss?" Elaine said. "Not a lot." Maybe it was nothing. "Where are Gordon and Sam?" Ian nodded toward the stairs. "Went to look at the merch stall." He looked worried. "Everything okay?" He gulped his pint and looked at the place he'd been standing arguing. "Maybe we should go," he said. "Why?" "I don't feel great. Too much skunk. I think I'm going to throw a whitey." He looked fine, and he never took a whitey. "You'll be okay in a minute," she said. "I really think we should go. You have to review it, remember?" He glanced around. "Let's just go and chill at the back," he said. They walked to the back of the hall where he slumped against the wall behind the sound desk. She realised she still had Gordon and Sam's drinks, so headed off to look for them. As she scanned the crowd, she kept hoping she'd see that guy again. Eventually, she walked right into Gordon and Sam up the back, huddled together. The music and lights dropped and a massive cheer went up, strobes flashing. The band strode out and launched into a rusty cage. Elaine glugged her pint and stared at Chris Cornell. She decided not to go back to Ian. This was a good spot. She could see perfectly. She tried to soak it up and stop her mind ticking over. She couldn't. Halfway through, Ian appeared at her shoulder. "You feeling better, babe?" she said. He nodded and gave her an awkward kiss. She tasted of beer and skunk. He'd sparked up another one on his own. So much for having a whitey. He was scribbling in a notepad now. "Writing nice things," Elaine said, nodding at the page. "Of course." She looked around, wondering where the guy was. Soundgarden raged through, "Loud Love" and "Hands All Over," then sloped off. Lights stayed down for the encore. "Think I'll phone this in," Ian said, waving his notebook. "I thought your deadline wasn't until midnight." He shrugged. "I've got enough, might as well do it now. Don't want you hanging around for ages afterwards while I dictate it." He put on a smile. "I'll meet you outside, yeah?" Soundgarden came back on stage, Cornell with his top off, Jesus Christ pose, then full on Kevin's mom, and they were gone. Elaine joined the sea of bodies swaying towards the stairs. Always a crazy bottleneck in this place. She looked around for Rose and for the guy Ian had been arguing with, but couldn't see anyone she recognised. She stumbled out the entrance. "Elaine." It was Rose behind her. "Hey," she said. "Great show, huh?" "Yeah, where's Alex?" "Doing the review. Ian too?" Elaine nodded. Awkward silence between them. Loads of bams wandering around, raucous noise from the Celtic pub. She saw Ian coming from a phone box across the street. He flinched when he saw that she was standing with Rose, then crossed the road. "Ian!" Elaine somehow knew who it was without turning. The look on Ian's face, a flash of fear. She turned and saw the guy from the argument. Ian was paralysed. The guy certainly perked up Rose's attention.
"Aren't you going to introduce me to your beautiful friends?" the guy said.
It was cheesy charm, but he had the charisma to pull it off somehow. Ian shook his head and sighed like a tired old man.
"Ladies, this is Johnny."
Johnny took Elaine's hand and kissed it. She was dismayed that she actually felt a tingle of something at that touch. Ridiculous. The guy moved on to Rose's hand.
"Your brother, Johnny," he said.
Elaine turned to Ian.
"You have a brother?"
Ian's face was full of apology.
"Not just a brother,"
Johnny said, putting his arm around Ian.
"A twin brother."
He mugged, putting his head on Ian's shoulder.
"Can't you see the family resemblance?"
Chapter 29. Parking was the usual nightmare, even at 7:45 in the morning. Cal nudged his mini round the rabbit warren of the Royal Edinburgh Hospital looking for spaces, but cars were already double and triple parked, blocked in or sprawled across chevron spaces with big warning signs. "Please leave free. Emergency ambulance access at all times." Martha sighed in the passenger seat. They could take as long as they wanted to find a space as far as she was concerned. She knew this was for the best, but she was nervous. She fingered the leaflet she'd brought with her, the one they'd sent with the appointment letter. She already knew all the ins and outs of ECT. This was her fourth set of shocks in 3 years, but she reread the introduction in an attempt to calm herself. Electroconvulsive therapy, ECT, has been used in Scotland for half a century. It is viewed in the medical profession as safe, effective and painless, with a low risk of unacceptable side effects. Furthermore, psychiatrists believe it can save lives. However, this view has not always been shared by the public. This is perfectly understandable. Much of what people believe about ECT comes from the way it is portrayed in films, television drama and documentary, where the purpose is often to entertain or to be controversial. No shit. So much stigma attached, and yet it had been the only thing that had worked for her. 5 years of different pills, each prescription less effective than the last. Feeling herself sink into a black hole. Then after reading stuff online and convincing her doctor, a feeling like no other after her first shock, someone punching the lights back on in her life. She had her appointments record with her. 3 previous courses, each consisting of 6 shocks, 2 per week spread over 3 weeks. Once a year, so far. Maybe there would come a day when it wasn't needed, or when the risk of side effects became too much. But for now, this was the least dreadful solution, and sometimes the least dreadful solution can be pretty damn good.
"Fuck it," Cal said.
Even the mini couldn't fit anywhere around here. Eventually, he just parked on a double yellow on the outskirts of the hospital grounds and they got out. Martha could use a coffee, but she wasn't allowed. Nil by mouth for 2 hours before treatment because of the general anaesthetic. Nothing at all to eat for 8 hours, just fluids. So the whiskey last night was okay. She probably wouldn't mention that to the consultant in case he pulled the plug. The Royal was Edinburgh's resident nuthouse. Not that such terms were used around here, very much frowned upon by those in the psychiatric profession. But it was a nuthouse. Originally a Victorian sprawl, peppered with sturdy oak trees strangled by ivy and holly bushes, it had accumulated growths like the Elephant Man over the years. Pre-war pebble dash here, 60s tower blocks there, miserable grey concrete of the 70s giving way to sickening bright colours on the newest buildings. They walked past the Child and Adolescent Mental Health Services building, where she'd attended as an outpatient since the age of 13. All softly spoken counselling and role-playing. Then the allotments and greenhouses for rehabilitating patients. Then the psychotherapy department. A year of talking things through in there amounted to fuck all. They walked past the mortuary. Martha didn't think about what was inside. Then they were at the Andrew Duncan Clinic, whoever Andrew Duncan was. Probably some old mental guy. through the automatic doors, down a gloomy corridor stinking of bleach, and they were there, the ECT department. She liked how they didn't have the full name. Electroconvulsive therapy. Even here, in the hospital, there was a stigma. They didn't want to talk about what went on beyond this door. Or maybe they were just saving on the lettering of the sign. Cal looked at her. "You okay?" She nodded. "You don't have to do this." She buzzed and was let in. "You know I do." It was the nurse she liked, the Irish one. Colleen on her name badge. Red hair in a feather cut, motherly smile. Martha handed over the letter. Colleen flicked through a box in her desk and came out with some paperwork. She handed over the forms on a clipboard. "If you want to take a seat and fill these out, dear." She looked at Cal. "And who's your handsome friend?"
"My brother, Cal."
"Ah, well." Martha sat down and went through the forms, just checking on her physical and mental health since the last visit. She'd already discussed this with her GP last week, but she knew from over the years with the NHS there was nothing they liked more than triple-checking things. She signed the consent slip last and handed back the forms. Colleen got up and took the clipboard through to a room behind her. Martha knew how this worked. From here into the prep room, lie down, needle in the hand, count back from 10. Then, according to Cal's footage, into the treatment room. Plugged into heart rate and blood pressure monitors and something that checked brain function. Then a couple of probes on the head, shoot a little juice across, bingo. No shuddering or jerking, thanks to the muscle relaxant and the anaesthetic. Like watching paint dry. Colleen came back. "The guys will be ready for you in a second." She looked at Martha. "Just try to relax." Martha put on a smile. "This is me relaxed, believe it or not." Colleen smiled back. Martha wanted to hug her. Cal rubbed her hand and she let him. She shot him a glance. "It'll be fine," he said.
"I know."
A middle-aged guy popped his head through the door. Martha recognised him from last time, the anaesthetist. He spoke to Colleen and disappeared.
"Let's get you going then," Colleen said.
She showed them through and Martha climbed onto a trolley. The anaesthetist gave Cal a look but didn't say anything. Another man was there with the anaesthetist, taller, side-parting, air of authority. He didn't introduce himself, but his badge read Dr. Pardew, consultant. Martha recognised him from last time as well. He lifted the clipboard and stood above Martha. He didn't show any signs of recognising her. She supposed they must do this to a lot of people. "Feeling fit and well?" he said.
"Fine."
"Nothing to eat or drink in the last few hours?" She shook her head and wondered if she stank of booze.
"Okay, just lie back and relax."
She felt the needle puncture her skin and slide into her.
"Now, count back from 10, will you?"
10? She thought about Gordon with his face gone.
9?
She thought of herself in a secure unit, the one and only time she'd been committed for her own safety 3 years ago.
8?
She thought of her dad lying on Platform 8 of Waverley Station and what had led him there. She was gone before she reached 7. Chapter 30. A simple fog. A heavy pulse behind her eyes. Voices. Her brother, Cal. And that nurse, the Irish one with the smile. She felt a hand on hers, rubbing. It felt spongy.
"Sure your sister has freezing hands.
She's always had terrible circulation."
"Cold hands, warm heart."
"So they say." Then closer to her ear.
"Gently does it, dear. You're just coming out of the anaesthetic."
"Possible short-term memory loss."
"Short-term memory loss."
"And headaches." That's what the leaflet said. She remembered that. A good sign. She opened her eyes. It felt embarrassing to be lying down with people standing over her. Cal and the nurse.
"Colette?"
"Possible short-term memory loss."
That smile.
Do you know where you are, dear?
Martha blinked a few times, heavy eyelids. She stretched her fingers under the nurse's hand, made a claw shape, then relaxed. Muscle relaxant.
Relax.
She nodded slowly.
Andrew Duncan Building. Who was he?
I have no idea, love, the nurse said. Martha saw her name tag.
Colleen.
She was close.
Just relax, Colleen said.
ECT. She remembered.
How did it go?
Oh, fine, Colleen said. Just take a few minutes, dear. Stay lying down. I need to go and get some more paperwork. They're terrible for it around here. I'll be back in a minute.
She bustled out the door.
How are you doing?
Cal over her.
She nodded. Her head felt light. No sign of a headache.
Good. How are you?
He laughed.
I'm fine, Munchkin.
Martha pushed herself onto her elbows and looked round. She remembered this room from last time.
A good sign.
The brown walls. Recovery room 1 on a small laminated sign above the door. A recess in one corner had another sign.
Oxygen.
There was no oxygen tank there. She remembered that too.
She remembered signing the consent form. Her head felt as if a breeze was blowing through it.
What was that song about windmills of your mind?
Old song.
Had she forgotten that? Or had she never known it?
She remembered thinking about Gordon and Ian and counting.
Very good signs.
She remembered about all the death, the obituaries, holding back the tears at the desk where Gordon was supposed to be.
Yesterday.
You okay? Cal said.
She looked around for a clock.
What time is it?
Cal checked his phone.
9.
Martha shook her head.
That was quick.
They don't hang around, Colleen said, coming back in. She handed Martha another form to sign. Martha signed, her hand slow. Colleen checked her pulse. Martha felt she couldn't speak while the nurse counted in her head.
Well, you're still alive, Colleen said.
Martha snorted a laugh despite herself. Her temples tingled like a static charge. She scratched at the skin.
That so?
It was the consultant, through from the treatment room. Martha stopped scratching and shook her head.
How is our patient? The consultant said.
Martha didn't know if he was talking to her or Colleen.
Fine,
she said. The doctor checked her eyes and ears, like doctors always did.
What did they ever learn from that? She half expected he would make her stick her tongue out.
The consultant had hairs bristling out his nose and ears. He wasn't old enough for that, only 40 or so. And he had a wisp of chest hair poking out from the neck of his shirt. It made Martha feel sick to look at it, trying to escape.
You feeling okay? The consultant said.
She nodded.
I think she can get her cup of tea now, nurse, he said.
Imagine not calling a colleague by her name.
Martha wondered if he even knew Colleen's name.
What an arrogant prick.
God complex bullshit, except this guy was only sticking 2 batteries against loonies' heads, hardly brain surgery.
Good stuff, the consultant said, already heading out the door. See you at your next appointment.
Door opened and closed.
Swish, swish.
Gone.
Martha swung herself off the bed and stood up. She wobbled. Her legs were weak. She felt heavy. Her body waiting to catch up with her mind. Cal put a hand out for her to take. She looked at it and shook her head, then headed for the door to recovery room 2. She remembered which way it was.
A good sign.
Through the doors, Colleen headed for the kettle.
Tea?
I could murder a coffee, Martha said.
Take a seat, Colleen said.
I'll stand, thanks.
She wanted to walk it off.
Active rather than passive. Living through moving. She paced round the room. It was the same decor as the rest of the building. scratchy 70s furniture, brown walls, bleach smell, dreary as hell. Enough to send you mad, if you weren't already. She got the coffee and gulped it as she walked about. Burnt her tongue, it was too hot. Cal sat in a busted chair and flicked through a magazine, keeping an eye on her. Martha gulped more coffee and put the cup down. She was full of energy now. Her legs worked and her heart pumped and her brain was clear. She wanted to do things. "Okay, I'm good," she said. "Let's go." Cal got up. Colleen frowned. "Are you sure, love?" Martha gave a sarcastic and condescending nod of the head, then regretted it. "Well, you know about taking it easy for the rest of the day, yeah?" "Of course," Colleen turned to Cal. "Make sure she does." "I'll try," Cal said. Martha picked her bag up and slung the strap over her shoulder. She heard the familiar plastic rattle of the cassette boxes in there and thought about the tape of her and Gordon. She opened the door and Colleen followed, placing a hand on her sleeve. "See you on Friday, then," Colleen said softly, like it was a visit to the dentist.
"Yeah, Friday,"
Martha said, and she was out the door, heading for the exit, Cal and Colleen exchanging a look. Chapter 31. Back at home. "Are you sure you're going to be all right?" Cal was leaving to open up the basement. Martha was freezing. She hadn't had this reaction before. Her hands were trembling, her bones felt thin and brittle. She wanted him out the door as soon as possible, so she just nodded, scared that her teeth might chatter if she tried to speak. Cal shook his head. "I'll phone in, someone else can do it." She knew this was just talk. He was the only one who had keys to open up, and the only one trusted by the owner anyway. He would have to go in. "I'm fine," she said. She pushed him out the door. "I'll call you in a bit," he said, already getting his car key out his pocket. "Don't bother," she said. "I will." She closed the door and went through to the living room, got on her knees and clicked the ignition for the gas fire. An old living flame thing, but it did the job. She grabbed Elaine's blanket from the back of the sofa and draped it round her shoulders, huddled next to the blue flames and the fake coal. What was the point of fake coal? No one was fooled. She felt the heat on her face, but her blood was still chilled. She switched the television on, but turned the sound down. Jeremy Kyle. Horrible freak show. She got her bag and opened it, emptied everything out. Makeup, keys, phone, cassettes, Walkman, Ian's notebook, and the stories she'd printed off, the ones about Ian and Billy. The two men in her life. She laughed at that. One dead and one fuck up. No headaches this time, just this chill through her. Weird. She plugged her headphones into the Walkman and shuffled through the tapes. Picked one out and inserted it. Teenage Fan Club, Bandwagon-esque. Cool title. Sarcastic. Pressed play. Feedback, lazy voice, chiming guitars. Very slack. She liked it. Short-term memory loss. She wanted to check, remind herself, did a mental inventory. She had started work 2 days ago at the Standard. Gordon Harris had shot himself on the phone. She was working next to V. She went to see her wrestle last night. Was that just last night? Cal and Billy were there. Billy was the family announcements guy on the Evening Standard. Also the guy from the headlines a couple of years ago, the Crags shootout guy. Rose was a reporter. She didn't like Martha, or did she? Martha's dad, Ian, threw himself off Northbridge 2 weeks ago. She didn't go to the funeral. What else was there to remember? She had drunk Ian's drink cabinet almost dry. She was enjoying her dad's weird taste in music that she never knew about. All those cassettes recorded from vinyl. He would have had to buy the TDK D90s, sit and tape the albums, write the track listings by hand. She could just click iTunes and it was there. So weird how much effort went into life 20 years ago. But Ian had never mentioned music to her. She had a thought. pulled out his obit, the one Gordon had written, scanned through it again. Short-term memory loss. There it was. The mention that he was heavily into the Edinburgh alternative music scene.
Really?
She tried to picture the middle-aged man she hardly knew as part of anything alternative.
Alternative to what? What did that even mean?
Another word in the obit, indie. What was the indie scene? Had this been the same time he was with Elaine, and if so, was she into the same music? She never played music round the house.
What had happened to these people?
She finished reading the obit, survived by his daughter Martha and his son Calvin. They were survivors.
Was that all?
She was fed up of being just a survivor. The heat from the fire was through to her bones now, but she kept the blanket wrapped round her anyway. She read the name at the bottom of Ian's obit, Gordon Harris. Dead. Last time she'd read this, he was only half dead. Someone would have to write his obit. Was that her job now, to go back and talk to Samantha? She thought about the recording of him. His voice, petrified of what he was about to do. Teenage fan club were singing about a metal baby now, vocal harmonies piling on top of each other. She picked up Ian's notebook and flicked through it. Remembered looking at the book twice before. That was good. Everything coming back to her. The two times before, she'd been drunk. Wide awake this time, head full of light. She could read the scrawl no problem. Wasn't as bad as she'd thought when drunk. Funny that. She read a few entries. Nothing exciting, just the day-to-day stuff of his life. It was from 1992, before she was born. He was already working at the Standard's offices, by the sound of it, trying to get a career going in journalism, just like her. She felt dizzy for a moment, something like déjà vu, her life telescoping back to her dad's, mirroring it a lifetime later. She really was following in his footsteps, for better or worse. Maybe the dizziness was the ECT. She felt her pulse. Seemed normal. The heat from the fire on her face was intense, but she liked it. Felt as if it was peeling an old layer of herself away. She flicked the page in the notebook. A very short entry about going to Glasgow for a gig. She laughed in recognition. It was Soundgarden. He mentioned Elaine, said they were with friends. She tried to imagine their friends in 1992. Then something that made her blood freeze all over again. She reread it, wanting to make sure. His writing was a mess, but it was clear enough. She read it a third time. The only downer was that my brother turned up. Ian had a brother. She never knew that. Why had she never heard about him before? She scrabbled through the pieces of paper scattered on the floor. Pulled out Ian's obit again, scanned it. No mention of a brother. How was that possible? Gordon was a professional obit writer. He wouldn't make a mistake like that. Unless it was kept from him too. But he had known Ian for years, since way back at the paper. More importantly, why the hell had Elaine or Ian never mentioned a brother? She grabbed her phone and called her mum. No answer, just Elaine's monotone on the voicemail. Elaine, it's Martha. Call me when you get this. She hung up and called Cal. He picked up after two rings. What is it? She could hear clanking of bottles in the background, a whirring noise. We have an uncle. What? I just read Ian's notebook. He mentioned a brother. So? Have you ever heard of our dad having a brother before?
No.
Don't you think that's a little strange?
No. We hardly knew the prick.
Martha shook her head. That's not good enough. Listen to me, Cal. Ian didn't like his brother for some reason. That's in the notebook. Elaine has never, ever mentioned him in 20 years. Gordon Harris wrote an obituary of Ian that didn't mention him. That's the clincher.
Why?
You don't leave that kind of shit out of an obit, Cal. That's specifically what an obit is for rounding up someone's life and name-checking the family. All the family, unless...
Unless what?
Unless there's something to hide.
Wait a minute. Something big.
You need to take it easy, Munchkin. Martha had the phone cradled in her neck and was shoving all the stuff back into her bag.
No, I need to do exactly the opposite.
Remember where you've just been this morning.
This has nothing to do with that. The side effects are memory loss and headaches, not imagining diary entries and realising your own mother has been lying to you for your whole life.
Cal sighed down the phone. Maybe she had a good reason.
Like what?
I don't know. Maybe he died 20 years ago, or emigrated, or disappeared.
That's still no reason to write him out of history.
Maybe she wanted to protect us.
From what?
The clanking down the phone had stopped.
Listen, I'm coming home.
Martha threw the blanket off her shoulders.
Don't bother, I'm going out.
Chapter 32.
Don't you get it?
Martha said. V ran a finger around her black eye and shrugged.
So your family has secrets. Whose doesn't?
Martha dumped her bag on the desk and shook her head.
Not like this. Not that get left out of official obituaries.
V looked puzzled.
Sure, that happens all the time.
What?
You think we check everything?
She rubbed her hand over her bicep.
If the family wants something hidden, it stays hidden. You wouldn't believe the number of euphemisms we use in this business. All bits are a total whitewash sometimes, trust me. I know you've only worked here 2 days, but even you must have noticed that.
Martha had, but this was different. She logged on to the computer.
What are you doing here anyway? V said. I told you to take the day off.
I'm fine.
Did you get the old...
V made a lightning fizzle noise and put her hands out like holding electrodes. Martha rolled her eyes.
Very subtle.
Well, it went fine. You seem a little hyper.
That's nothing to do with it.
Martha fixed her gaze on V.
I'm not bipolar. I don't get crazy highs, just lows, so that's not what this is. I'm just thinking clearly for the first time in ages. I know this is important.
V held her hands up.
It's your life.
Martha took a deep breath. On the bus on the way in, she'd called Elaine 4 more times. No answer. She'd flicked through Ian's notebook, but hadn't found another mention of his brother. She logged on to the copy system and searched for Ian Lamb. There were hundreds of hits with his byline. He had written something most days in the years he'd worked here. She scanned down them, but apart from stuff by him, there was just Gordon's obit.
Shit, Gordon. He would need his own obit now.
She went on to the local hard drive of Gordon's computer. Hundreds of different folders. She searched again. 3 hits, different versions of the obit. She opened all 3, clicked the last 2 to the back and started reading the first. The text was almost the same, just a little sloppier. But then she read the last line. Ian is survived by his daughter Martha and son Calvin and his twin brother Johnny. Her heart was a jackhammer.
A twin, just like her and Cal. It ran in the family.
She checked the second draft. It had been changed to cut him out.
I told you, she said to V.
What?
First draft of Gordon's obit for Ian mentions a twin brother called Johnny.
V peered over.
Really? What does it say?
Nothing,
she thought for a moment.
Except that he's still alive. A survivor.
V nodded.
Uncle Johnny, eh? Wonder why he got scrubbed from the rewrite.
Martha checked the date on the file.
Both versions were written 2 months ago, a day apart. 6 weeks before Ian jumped off North Bridge.
V sucked her teeth.
Yeah, that's pretty common.
What?
A lot of us have done our obits already.
Really?
You want to make sure it's good. Do you want to read mine?
Martha frowned.
So you're saying Ian might have written this?
V shook her head.
Not his speciality.
More likely Garden spoke to him, wrote it, then showed him a draft. So maybe Ian vetoed the mention of his brother?
Could be, V said.
Although that begs the question, why did Ian mention him in the first place?
Unless he didn't, Martha said. Unless Gordon already knew about him. They both worked here from around the same time, didn't they?
No idea. Isn't it a little suspicious that Gordon just happened to write Ian's obit for him a few weeks before he jumped off North Bridge? Not if Ian was already thinking of killing himself. I mean, sorry to be blunt, but that's the obvious answer. He was already thinking of doing it, so he wanted to make sure Gordon wrote something decent.
This doesn't add up. Where's Gordon's obit? Did he write one for himself?
V pointed at Martha's screen. Have a look.
Martha searched the system, then the local hard drive. Nothing.
Why would he phone his in on the day when he was premeditating enough to have bought a gun from somewhere? If he was ready to die, why not write his own obit?
V got out her seat and rested her arse on the edge of Martha's desk.
You're thinking too much about this, she said. You need to go home.
No.
You're applying logical thinking to suicide, V said. It doesn't work that way.
Martha waved at V to get off the desk.
We're getting off the point, she said. My dad has a brother. I need to find him.
Straight onto Google with Johnny Lamb. Nothing obvious. Tried John Lamb. Lots of sportsmen, musicians, a few American politicians. She checked the first version of the name in the standards database. Again, nothing to shout about. Then the second version. Some junior footballer had loads of mentions in match reports. She switched the timeline from newest to oldest. Top of the list was an Evening Standard court report dated September 1992. She clicked. Just a short paragraph, about the same length as the piece reporting Ian's death 2 weeks ago. A young Edinburgh man was sectioned under the Mental Health Act yesterday and sent to Carstairs Secure Psychiatric Hospital for indefinite supervision. John Lamb, 22, was arrested on September the 12th after a violent incident on North Bridge. Although North Bridge remained open throughout the incident, Market Street was blocked for several hours afterwards and Mr. Lamb was taken to hospital, along with one other unnamed person. At the hearing, Judge Evans said he believed Mr. Lamb continued to be a danger both to himself and others, and he will be held in care until such time as he is no longer considered to be a danger to the public at large.
Chapter 33.
Holy shit! V raised her eyebrows. What now?
Martha turned her screen for V to read the article. V squinted at it and frowned.
Might not be the same Johnny Lamb.
Oh, come on, Martha said. We both know what an incident on North Bridge means.
Suicide bid. Same place Ian did it 20 years later. It can't be a coincidence.
V rubbed her elbow and shrugged.
So chase it up.
What?
You're the one wants to be the hotshot reporter. Go investigate.
What do you know about Carstairs? Martha said.
Not much. It's a loony bin.
Martha spotted Billy returning to his desk.
Billy, what do you know about Carstairs Psychiatric Hospital?
Billy came over and Martha got him up to speed.
You think Johnny's still there?
Billy said.
It's somewhere to start, Martha said.
Billy pointed at the phone.
So, ask them.
Martha googled Carstairs. The website was all NHS branding and corporate speak. It was just called the State Hospital now, no mention of mental illness. Martha scanned the site for a few minutes, but whoever had written it had taken a course in flannel. Everything was couched in vague language, impossible to glean anything. She eventually found a contact number and picked up the phone. Had a faint shudder at the touch of the handset to her ear, remembering Gordon's voice. She dialed. A Glasgow accent. Middle-aged, female.
Hello, the State Hospital, how can I help you?
I'm trying to find out if someone is still a patient there.
I'm afraid we can't give out that information over the phone.
He was admitted 20 years ago, but I've only just found out about it.
Like I said, we have patient confidentiality to consider. Martha rubbed her forehead and squeezed her eyes shut.
I'm a relative. He's my uncle.
If you have the name and number of someone on the patient's clinical team, and if the patient has approved it, I can let you speak to them. The woman sounded like she got this all day. She was a rock.
Well, obviously I don't have that information, Martha said, or I wouldn't be wasting my time talking to you.
I'm very sorry, but I can't help you. She didn't sound sorry.
His name's John, or Johnny Lamb. Can you just look him up?
Maybe I didn't make myself clear, the woman said. It is illegal for me to divulge that information over the phone.
Okay, can you suggest how I might find out if someone is a patient there?
Under the Freedom of Information Act, anyone who requests non-personal information held by the state hospital, subject to certain conditions and exemptions, is entitled to receive it.
Well, I'm requesting it now, Martha said, so fucking tell me.
All requests must be made in writing. By law, we must respond to requests within 20 working days, but we can ask for more details in order to identify the information requested. She was obviously reciting from memory.
20 days in writing?
Martha clawed at her face. Her blood felt overheated.
I'm sorry, that's the best we can do, the woman said.
Okay, thanks for nothing, Martha hung up. She shook her head at Billy and V.
Freedom of information. We can apply in writing. Find out in a month.
Or we could go there and see what we can find out, Billy said.
Chapter 34. Half a dozen horses flicked their tails at a trough or chewed on the long grass. Behind them was a 20-foot fence topped with tight spools of razor wire. Behind the razor wire, the prison hospital. Martha was driving Cal's Mini, Billy in the passenger seat. They'd left the office and hoofed it down to the basement. Cal was reluctant when she told him why they wanted his car, but he gave in. She would only get a taxi for 200 quid otherwise. He told Billy to watch out for her, gave him a look. Halfway to Carstairs, she got a call from Cal. She switched her phone off without answering, knew he would just be nagging her. Billy spent the journey down the A702 on his phone, reading out bits of blurb from the Carstairs website, surfing around trying to find out anything about Johnny Lamb. He called someone he knew at the sheriff court, but the records of the John Lamb case were archived, so the guy couldn't get them easily without a written application. What was it about the old days when everything had to be done in writing? Martha couldn't remember the last time she'd had to put pen to paper to write an actual letter. Stone Age stuff. She pulled over to the side of the road to get a better view of the place. Anonymous low buildings, yellow and grey, built from the 60s onwards, with some new building work off in a corner of the grounds, cranes and diggers shifting earth. The plan was that they didn't really have a plan. According to the website, you were supposed to fill out an online form to apply for a visit. That would be passed on to the clinical team, who would consider it, discuss it with the patient if appropriate, then get back to you in writing.
In writing? Jesus, this place was keeping the pen and paper business going single-handed.
Then you were meant to get an authorised pass with your picture on it.
But there were ways round, that's what Billy said.
There were ways round anything. Martha pulled the Mini away from the verge and headed towards the visitors' car park. The horses didn't raise their heads. No problems getting a parking space, no sign of security yet either. Large NHS-branded signs. All visitors, please go to reception. They got out and looked at each other over the roof of the Mini, the sun glinting off the surface between them. Martha laid her hand on the car roof. The spring sunshine wasn't enough to warm the metal under her fingers.
You think he'll still be here? She said. After all this time?
I have no idea, Billy said. Maybe he died.
Gordon Zobit said he was a survivor.
A survivor?
As in, Ian Lamb is survived by.
Martha thought for a moment, then pointed at reception.
You'd better do the talking. It could be the same woman from the phone. She might recognise my voice.
Billy shrugged.
Okay.
They went in. Another bland waiting room, beige furniture, cheap wooden reception desk. Martha knew from looking that it was the same woman she'd spoken to. Hard face, weathered beyond her years, spiky brown hair, clumpy body under blouse and skirt. Name tag said, Brenda.
Billy started talking to her. Martha hung back, pretending to examine a leaflet on living with schizophrenia, listening in to the pair of them.
Billy was getting nowhere.
She wanted to run over and grab the woman by her blouse and scream in her face. Billy was never going to get in this way. All the sweet talking in the world wasn't going to win Brenda over.
Martha took a deep breath and put the leaflet down, then walked out the front door without looking back. She walked to the nearest fence, gazed up at the razor wire, imagined what it must feel like to be on the other side of that. A guy in a hoodie with a Rangers tattoo on his neck stood outside the front door, smoking a roll-up. She walked away from his gaze and round the corner, tried a fire exit. Locked. Walked on further, just a thin strip of grass and a worn, muddy path. The path meant that people came this way, so she followed it. Round a second corner, the path ended at another exit, this time with an electronic keypad and lock fitted. Three women in tabards were standing outside, sucking on cigarettes. They were all middle-aged with bad dye jobs, blonde, henna and some crazy purple. Heavy lines on their faces, years of hard graft and nicotine. She kept walking towards them and they glanced up at her.
"Excuse me," Martha said.
"Idol," said the one with henna streaks. Martha put on her little girl voice, innocent eyes.
"I think I've got a wee bit lost. I'm supposed to be visiting someone."
The woman took another drag, then pointed behind Martha.
"Reception's run that way. Don't know how you missed it." "Thanks," Martha said. "Sorry, I don't normally lose my bearings. I'm a bit all over the place."
She went to turn, then stopped.
"I'm visiting my uncle. Maybe you've met him. Johnny Lamb."
Henna smiled at the other two, who gave her a knowing look back.
"Oh, aye, we all know Johnny Lamb. Took turns cleaning his ward. Never forget a handsome face like his. You're Johnny's niece."
Martha nodded.
"Fucking idiots," Henna said.
"What?"
Martha's heart hammered away at her ribs.
"Johnny got transferred, did they not tell you?"
Martha shook her head.
"Don't you look old enough to have a pretty grown-up niece, mind you. Have you visited him before? I haven't seen you about."
"No, I just moved back to Scotland after years away."
"Don't think he ever mentioned a niece."
Henna was scratching her chest, remembering.
"Just a brother."
"That'll be my dad, Ian."
"Ian, aye, that's right."
Henna turned to the others.
"The brother came to visit a few times recently, didn't he?"
The blonde one nodded. Martha's throat was dry.
"How recently?"
"Up until Johnny got transferred," Blondie said. "Around Christmas time."
"Where was he transferred to?"
Blondie narrowed her eyes.
"Surely your dad would have told you."
Martha put on a sorry face. She was really hamming it up.
"We don't get on, me and my dad. Haven't spoken in 2 years.
The three women looked as if they understood bad fathers all too well.
"My old man was a bastard too," Henna said. "But take it from me, you'll want to make it up between you afore it's too late. My dad's dead now."
"Do you know where Johnny was transferred to?"
They all shook their heads.
"His brother signed off on it," Blondie said. "At least that's what Johnny said anyway, so it'll be the nearest psychiatric hospital to where your dad lives, probably."
"Royal Edinburgh, would that make sense?"
"Could be," Henna said, throwing her fag butt into the grass. "Sounds like you've had a wasted journey. Idiots in this place didn't know their arses from their elbows."
Martha put on a big smile.
"Well, thanks for all your help anyway."
Henna shrugged.
"No worries, doll."
Martha turned and walked away, trying to keep her stride steady on the muddy grass. Billy was sitting on the bonnet of the Mini, scrolling on his phone. He looked up when he heard her footsteps.
"Where did you go?"
Martha unlocked the car.
Just for a mooch around. How did you get on at reception?
Billy shook his head as he got up.
Totally stonewalled.
Lucky one of us got somewhere then.
She couldn't stop grinning. Billy looked at her.
What?